This is Functional Medicine Update for July 2001, Volume 21, Number 7. This month's issue covers the general topic of nutrition and immunity in healthy aging. We will begin Side 1 with a report on preventing cognitive decline, followed by the graying of the immune system. Our interview will be with Dr. R.K. Chandra, discussing his lifetime of research on nutrition, aging, and immunity. On Side 2, we will continue on this topic with several items of interest, including vitamin E's impact on immunity and cardiovascular health, allergy and allergic diseases, tolerance and autoimmunity, gut flora and GI function, folic acid and homocysteine, and the effect of protein on blood glucose levels in type 2 diabetes. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the July 2001 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to July Functional Medicine Update, year 2001. Well, we're very excited this month to continue our theme as it relates to the prevention of diseases of the aged and relationship specifically to healthy aging. This month we'll be focusing on nutrition and immunity as it relates to protection against age-related diseases, and focus on the nature of how the specific single nutrients and complex nutrition within our diet influence both cell-mediated and non-cell-mediated immunity. To start, however, we probably should take a perspective from the recent white paper published out of the Institute for the Study of Aging and the International Longevity Center entitled Achieving and Maintaining Cognitive Vitality with Aging. This is a very interesting report that was recently published, which is available through the Institute on Aging, which reviews a workshop that studied with international experts in the field the whole nature of how to prevent cognitive decline with aging. By the way, those of you that are interested in getting a copy of this monograph can do so from the Institute for the Study of Aging, 767 Fifth Avenue, Suite 4600, New York, New York, 10153. Their fax is 212-572-4094, and we will put that all on the summary cards for your information. The workshop report was very interesting in that it defined a number of areas that are considered important for the protection against the loss of cognitive function, including intellectual stimulation and lifelong learning, continued and regular exercise throughout aging, daily activities that relate to social stimulation, stress reduction. This goes back to the Dr. Robert Sapolsky connection to chronic stress and brain aging. Sleep, 6 to 8 hours of regular sleep, very important for the protection against premature brain aging. Emotional stability, they put as their point number 6. And number 7, nutrition. Nutrition that contains adequate levels of specific nutrients that are necessary for the promotion of proper brain function and immune balance, says the study. The risks and benefits then goes on to say of using specific nutrients in higher than normal doses beyond that of the recommended dietary intakes. They talked about antioxidants, for instance, in this report, and we'll talk much more about that in this month's Functional Medicine Update with our clinician of the month. How do specific nutrients like antioxidants play a role in the protection of immune function and cognitive function with aging? There are other agents which people have suggested are important for the protection against the loss of cognitive function: DHEA, melatonin, testosterone, human growth hormone, various types of herbal botanical materials, including Hypericum, St. John's wort for depression, and Silymarin for oxidative stress, and, of course, ginkgo biloba for the protection of cognitive function. All of these certainly have been highlighted with great enthusiasm, but in comparison to the other issues that I've described, probably pale in comparison as it relates to how they impact the brain in terms of its function over the life of decades. Lifelong learning, exercise, daily activity, stress reduction, sleep, emotional stability, and nutrition probably play the principal roles in shaping the genotype into its phenotype, or urging a phenotype of healthy brain aging and its association with healthy immune function. Well, that leads then to an interesting question. Is cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease really locked into the genes. Those of us who have followed this field for a number of years recognize that there's this implication that diseases of premature brain aging are really hardwired into our genes, and there's little we can do to overcome our book of life, our 23 pairs of chromosomes, our chapters in our book of life that code for these premature brain aging disorders and immunologically related disorders like autoimmune disease. Well, that particular association has recently been studied in a paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 285, page 739, in the year 2001, which I think is quite fascinating. It's a cross-cultural study looking at the incidence of dementia and Alzheimer's disease in two communities. These are ethnically black individuals either residing in Nigeria or African Americans residing in Indianapolis, Indiana. And the study was attempting to see whether genes or environment were the major predictors for loss of cognitive function with aging. Now, clearly, there's a lot of variables that one has to concern themselves with when you start trying to compare Yoruba individuals residing in Abanda, Nigeria versus Indianapolis, Indiana, African Americans. But trying to take into account these various factors through good statistical methods, some very interesting differences between the two groups were seen. And I'll just read the conclusion and then talk a little bit about what this might say. The authors go on to say that this is the first report of an incidence rate difference for dementia and Alzheimer's disease in studies of these two populations, one from non-industrialized and the other from industrialized countries, using identical methods in the same group of investigators in both sites. Exploration of the population differences may identify, they say, potentially modifiable environmental or genetic factors that account for site differences in dementia and Alzheimer's disease being seen to be much higher in the Indianapolis, Indiana African American versus their genetic counterpart in Abandon, Nigeria. Well, the editorial that follows this is, I think, quite fascinating because it causes us once again to inspect or reflect upon this gene hardwiring genetic determinism view of diseases of aging. The population of African Americans older than 65 years and therefore at risk to Alzheimer's disease and other dementias is increasing even faster, interestingly enough, than the white population in the United States. However, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in African Americans versus whites appears to be comparable in the United States. This is to be contrasted with developing countries such as the individuals in Nigeria, where vascular dementia is much more prevalent and is seen as a major risk to dementia versus Alzheimer's disease. Whereas the familial risk of Alzheimer's disease appears similar in African Americans and whites, the specific factors conferring genetic susceptibility and their mode of action may differ between these groups. The most widely accepted factor, as you know, to identify genetic risk to Alzheimer's disease is the carriage of the APOE4 allele, the epsilon-4 allele. And this particular allele can either be homo or heterozygous. Homozygous, meaning that you have both from your mother and your father the gift of an APOE4 allele, has between a 12.5 and a 14.9 times increase in the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease. Whereas the heterozygous form, where you only have one allele of E4 of the two, is between 2.7 and 3.2 times the incidence of Alzheimer's versus those who do not carry the APOE4 allele. This is the strongest association between a genetic marker to date that's been discovered and the onset of Alzheimer's disease. The epsilon-4 association or the E4 association is also evident in the Japanese population cross-cultural studies as well. And two community-based cohorts of African Americans, however, suggest that these E4 effects are significant, much weaker in the E4 homozygotes and absent altogether in the E4 heterozygotes. The reasons for these ethnic differences in the E4 effect are still unclear, and that's one of the things that they were really studying in this particular cross-cultural evaluation of African versus United States individuals. Comparing the ratio of Alzheimer's disease to vascular dementia is also informative. In Western nations, the prevalence rate of moderate to severe dementia among those older than 65 years is 4.6%, with an Alzheimer's to vascular dementia ratio of 1.7 to 1, meaning higher Alzheimer's disease than vascular dementia by almost a factor of 2. In Japan, the prevalence rate of dementia is similar, about 4.5%, but the ratio is reversed. Alzheimer's disease to vascular dementia is only 0.5, meaning almost twice as many vascular dementias as Alzheimer's disease. So although you have a similar rate of dementia, the breakdown into the different types of the etiology is absolutely reversed. This has to do with, obviously, the greater numbers of strokes in Japan versus in the United States. When doing cross-cultural evaluations of Japanese Americans looking at Hawaii and Washington State, it's found as persons migrated from Japan to Hawaii or Washington State, this vascular dementia to Alzheimer's dementia ratio changed from that which it is in Japan, meaning higher vascular dementia, lower Alzheimer's dementia, to become within one generation the same as it is in the United States, higher Alzheimer's dementia, lower vascular dementia. Now, what does this say about the genetic nature of Alzheimer's disease? Clearly, it indicates or suggests strongly that it's modifiable based upon environment, because the genes of that individual did not change as they moved from Japan to the United States. What changed was the environment in which the genes were bathed. And it's this concept that our genes are bathed by different experiences, nutrition, environment, which then creates an outcome in their expression that then produces the phenotype, that the emerging view of this much more plastic construct around age-related diseases. And now we're focusing specifically on what you'd call, I guess, functional neurology. Well, this is very interesting. If you move on in this study that I'm describing in JAMA, the age-adjusted prevalence rates of Alzheimer's disease and dementia are significantly lower in Yoruba, in other words, in Nigeria, than in community-dwelling African-Americans living in Indianapolis. And therefore, what you start seeing is a 3- to 4-fold difference in the overall prevalence of dementia of individuals who are genetically linked. And of those, the Alzheimer's disease versus vascular dementia ratio also changes, which is fascinating, suggesting a great degree of plasticity as to how these genes are expressed in different environments. The age-standardized annual incidence rates for both dementia and Alzheimer's are 2 to 3 times lower in Yoruban versus African Americans in Indianapolis based upon this study. They used a lot of variable analysis and tried to control the various factors to tease out these data. The explanation is obviously very complex because there are many variables that we could use to describe these differences. If the estimates are accurate, they imply a very significant non-genetic factor for the vulnerability to Alzheimer's disease as it relates to environment. This explanation indicates very interesting associations between the APOE4 genotype, because it turns out that the penetration of the APOE, both heterozygous and homozygous E4 allele, is the same in those Black Americans living in Indianapolis versus those living in Nigeria, Tanzania, or Kenya, suggesting that one cannot just use an E4 allele prevalence argument to explain the differences between Alzheimer's disease and the two cultures. Well, this leads then to other questions, doesn't it? Is it possible that there are other risk-enhancing or protective genetic factors that may account for some of the differences in incidence rates that are modified by the environment in their expression? Are there things such as diet and exercise that increase then or decrease the risk of the expression of Alzheimer's disease in these individuals? We know, as we've discussed in previous editions of Functional Medicine Update, that the E4 allele may not be fully expressed in its genotype of oxidative stress until it is exposed to a very high saturated fat diet. And this may mean that the E4 allele genotype is the exquisite saturated fat sensitive individual for whom, if they're plunged then into the American diet of high saturated fat, may increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease through increased oxidative stress, effects on macrophage, attachment to endothelia, and other influences it has then on cell immunological function. For instance, transgenic mice prone to developing Alzheimer's disease when fed a hypercholesterolemic high saturated fat diet produce significantly higher levels of amyloid beta peptide, suggesting alterations in amyloid precursor protein associated with increased oxidative stress that are in response to this high fat, high cholesterol diet. So these genetic factors that we may have thought of as kind of, quote, death sentences, end quote, may be much more modifiable in their expression if we recognize them and then pattern the environment, nutrition and lifestyle and environment of that individual to be consistent with their own specific genetic needs. The authors of this epidemiological cross-cultural study on Alzheimer's disease go on to say in the close, quote, if modifiable factors such as diet were found conclusively to modulate the risk of Alzheimer's disease to the degree suggested by this research, then we would all indeed rejoice at its implications. And in the seemingly endless tug of war between genetic and non-genetic influences in disease, the nature-nurture question, new emphasis will emerge not only on the environmental factors, but also on the complex interactions between genetic predisposition and environmental triggers. While this research is only one step and the first of many needed to establish such a connection, the possibility that unique genetic and environmental risk profiles could weave together and be established and substantially alter our current understanding of Alzheimer's disease and lead to new prevention methods. If such profiles could be established, cognitive enhancing treatments could be tailored to a particular risk group. Well, that is the essence of functional medicine as you have heard us describe it over the last several years. I think it's a beautiful example of that particular association. And that leads us then into this month's questions with our clinician of the month. The clinician of the month that's helped us to understand this gene-nutrient interrelationship with specific focus on immunological status throughout the aging process. I'm now speaking to Dr. Rajit Kumar Chandra, medical doctor and very well-known pioneer researcher in the nutrient and immunity area. In an editorial that he authored in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 277, page 1398, in 1997, entitled Graying of the Immune System, Can Nutrient Supplements Improve Immunity in the Elderly? He was quoted as saying, it is recognized that nutrient intake should not only prevent the classic deficiency diseases, but also could reduce illness and improve health. The type of nutrients and the quantity required to achieve such a beneficial effect varies with the index being studied and whether more than one nutrient is being administered simultaneously. For some nutrients, the amounts proposed as being helpful apparently cannot be provided by a reasonable quantity and variety of natural foods. Thus, nutrient supplements may be important for health promotion and prevention of certain chronic diseases. This view goes against the prevailing dogma in nutritional science that a balanced diet is sufficient to achieve all nutritional objectives. Aging is associated with a reduction in many immune responses in most, but not all, elderly individuals. Immune dysfunction, as assessed by the prevalence of autoantibodies, also increases in the elderly. Therefore, what is the role of nutrition in the aging immune system? I go on to finish his quote. He says, the era of nutrient supplements to promote health and reduce illness is here to stay. In selected groups, such as the elderly, there is overwhelming evidence of immunological enhancement following a nutritional intervention. Some data suggest that a reduction in the incidence and duration of infection may also occur. In North America, a year's supply of micronutrient supplementation costs less than 3 visits to a physician and much less than a hospitalization for 1 day. Thus, these preliminary data suggest that a micronutrient supplement may be a cost-effective preventive intervention in old age. Deficiencies of vitamins and trace elements are observed in almost 1/3 of the elderly. It is expensive and impractical to estimate dietary intake or blood levels of various nutrients in individuals. Since there is no evidence to suggest that physiological amounts of vitamins and trace elements given for prolonged periods have any toxic or adverse consequences, and given the high prevalence of deficiencies of several micronutrients in old age, it would be prudent to opt for a suitable micronutrient supplement in modest amounts for all elderly individuals in order to achieve the maximum physiological health and benefit with the least risk of toxicity, end quote. That's our Clinician of the Month this month, Dr. Rajit Chandra, and I'm very pleased to introduce him to you, and we'll discuss this emerging topic of nutrition and immunity. Each of us have our mentors, those people that we have looked to really guide us in our thinking, and one of those in my list is Dr. Rajit Kumar Chandra, University Research Professor at Memorial University of Newfoundland and Director of the Immunology at the Janeway Child Health Center in St. John's.
Most of you know his work over the last 20 plus years as being one of the principal guideposts for us in the area of nutritional immunology. He has been a director of the World Health Organization Center for Nutrition Immunology, and he's a first Carnegie visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University, and is a combination medical doctor, a researcher who has really pioneered a field for us to help us understand the role that nutrients and nutrition have on various aspects of cell-mediated and non-cell-mediated immunity. So it's with great pleasure that we welcome you, Dr. Chandra, to a Functional Medicine Update. How did you come from pediatrics into nutritional immunity as the place that you spent your professional career?
Well, the story began in India, where I was working in a medical school in the Department of Pediatrics. As most people working in such a setting would know, there were many children admitted each day with infection, and we would often lose at least 10 or 15% of them within a day, mainly because of the underlying malnutrition. So this led to the thinking whether nutrition is a key element of immunity and resistance to infection. So beginning in the late 60s, we started to investigate this on a more systematic way.
Certainly in the 80s and then going on into the 90s, you have published a number of papers that I would consider to be primary resource papers in the field. One which really struck my attention was in The Lancet, looking at the effect of vitamin and trace element supplementation on immune responses and infection in elderly subjects, which I think opened the minds to a lot of doctors that a diet of variety and moderation may not be enough to properly support the immune systems of aging individuals whose diet intakes are questionable. Could you tell us a little bit about this evolving story of nutrition in the elderly?
Yes, I would take a couple of minutes first to lay the background. We know that as many as 40% of seniors, even in industrialized countries like U.S., Canada, and Western Europe, have low levels of many nutrients. That would be defined as nutritional deficiency. We also know that many of them have more frequent and prolonged infection. So putting the two things together, we looked at a group of 96 subjects who were apparently healthy and independently living, divided them into two groups. One received a supplement of all the vitamins and trace elements, and the other was on a placebo. The amounts we gave them were within physiological limits, and they were not mega doses. Not unexpectedly, but certainly it was to some extent a surprise that we found not only an improvement in immune responses like cell-mediated immunity, NK cell number and activity, interleukin-2 production, antibody response to flu vaccine, but the bottom line, which was most heartening, was that the group receiving the supplement had less infection, 23 days in a period of 12 months, compared with 48 days in the placebo group. So I think this clearly showed in a fairly well-designed trial that a supplement is needed in elderly people.
In your McCollum Award lecture, which was published, as I recall, back in 1991 in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, you talked about lessons from the past and new insights into the future as it pertains to this nutrition and immunity connection. I think a lot of practicing physicians have not really probably studied the impact that nutrition has, or nutrients, specific single nutrients, may have on the immunological system. I remember Dr. Beisel had a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association talking about single nutrient effects on immunological function. Could you tell us a little bit about what kinds of changes in the immune system one might suspect have nutritional relationships?
I think virtually every aspect of immunity can be affected depending upon the nutrient involved and the extent or severity of deficiency. Some nutrients like zinc have a very wide-ranging effect on immune responses and risk of infection. Others, such as iron, may have more effect on phagocyte function compared with, let us say, the complement system. So there is no doubt that most essential nutrients, be they vitamins or trace elements, do affect the immune system, some aspects being more affected than others. And I had the privilege of being in the group that Dr. Beisel chaired, based on which that report in the Journal of the American Medical Association appeared. Most of us now do believe that in the community, in the hospital setting, as well as in more serious situations like intensive care units or after surgery, nutrition plays a key role in maintaining our immunity and preventing serious infection.
It's interesting to me in that one of the paradoxes that is related to this nutrient and immunity connection is that we, as you've described, there are changes associated with delayed hypersensitivity, reduced interleukin production and decreased lymphocyte response to mitogens and low seroconversion and decreased antibody. But the other part that seems maybe to some people paradoxical is that there's an increased level of autoantibodies that are seen in aging individuals. How do we rationalize this, what appears to be the immune system working overtime, while it's also, in certain aspects, not working effectively?
I think even though superficially it may seem paradoxical, but if you look at how the immune system works and how interactions take place between different aspects of immunity, it is quite logical. We know that some parts of the immune system act almost like a surveillance. They keep the balance between the so-called good immunity, which is mainly mediated by T cells, and is also dependent upon these cells producing various cytokines like interleukins and gamma interferon. On the other hand, there are other aspects of the immune system which are kept in check by this good immunity. And you mentioned about autoimmunity. So it makes sense that if your protective immunity is reduced, then the surveillance is lost to some extent, and diseases like autoimmune disorders, cancer, will increase. And in the last 5 years, we've also learned that the Th1 cell and Th2 cell have a balance between the two. So if your good immunity to infections is impaired, then you may have more allergies as well. And it's a very interesting new concept that children in their early years should be exposed actually to some infections, because this will protect them from going towards the allergy route.
Oh, you have raised some very, very important and interesting topics there. I think, again, for the clinician, I want to emphasize what you've just said, because often I think there is this belief in the mind of a clinician that if the cell-mediated immunity is suppressed, that necessarily doesn't correlate with autoimmunity. And this crosstalk that you're describing between suppression of localized immune defense and how it can have an effect on the lack of recognition of self versus non-self, to me, is clinically a very, very interesting question when we're seeing more and more autoimmune disorders appearing in younger age individuals.
Yes, you're perfectly right, and I think we have to recognize that the immune system is a complex host defense mechanism, and all its aspects don't necessarily move in the same direction. Given a certain environmental factor like diet, some aspects may be impaired, but others may be working overtime and produce disorders as a result of that.
So that leads to the second interesting point that you raised, and that concerns nutrition and allergen exposure in youth or even in infancy. And you were, I think, the singular author in a new paper that appeared in the Proceedings of the Nutrition Society in year 2000, entitled Food Allergy and Nutrition in Early Life, Implications for Later Health. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that's a most interesting article that you've authored.
Briefly, we recognize that in the last 15 to 20 years, there has been an increasing incidence of allergic diseases in children. The reasons are not entirely clear, whether it is the houses which are now very tightly ventilated, the presence of house dust mite, tobacco smoke, it's all trapped within the house. But also, of course, genetic factors are important. But what we and others have now found is that given a family history of allergy, if the child is put on a restricted diet from the time of birth, and by this I mean he should be breastfed if possible, and then introduced to other types of proteins like cow's milk in a very gradual fashion, and the most serious food allergies due to egg, fish, and peanut would indicate that these food items should be introduced much later. We, for example, now all believe that peanut products should not be given until 3 years of age, and all this makes a difference in addition to the environmental control about dust or tobacco smoke and so on.
And how does this relate, if at all, to the question that I very frequently get concerning soy infant formula, the desirability for infants based upon its immunopotential?
Initially, people used, and I think many still use, soya as an alternative to cow's milk formula to prevent allergies. But I think there are now more than 25 well-designed studies which all show that this does not happen, that soya formulas are not protective against food allergy. And in fact, soya itself can be quite allergenic. So if you take children who already have allergy to milk and you put them on soya, as many as 40% will develop hypersensitivity to soya as well. I strongly feel that the best formula to go for in such a situation, whether you're talking of prevention or treatment, is a hydrolyzed or a pre-digested formula. And depending upon the situation, you may use a partially hydrolyzed one, which is available in two or three different brands like Good Start or NAN, or you can go for the highly hydrolyzed ones like Nutramigen or Progestimil, etc. So instead of soya, I would definitely say the evidence is for the use of a hydrolyzed formula, which will be beneficial not only for treatment, but even for prevention.
We've talked about nutrition and aging, and then we've gone to the other end of the continuum, nutrition in infancy, as it relates to the immune system. I think that leaves an interesting story in between, which is nutrition for the heavy exercising athlete. There are a lot of athletes who have wondered whether their heavy exercise program increases their immunological potential or whether it causes immunosuppression, and if so, at what level does that occur, and does it relate in female athletes at all to the loss of their menstrual periods and the difficulties with certain hormone balances? Can you tell us a little bit about what you have found concerning the nutritional status of young female athletes and its relationship to their immune system?
Certainly. I think there are several confounding factors that we have to consider in this particular relationship. If you look at young female athletes who are into very vigorous programs, or even if you look at ballet dancers who intentionally lose or keep their weight quite low, with the other consequences, for example, you mentioned about amenorrhea, there could be several psychological problems. In fact, they could go on to develop frank anorexia nervosa or bulimia. In these girls, we have found, particularly in studies that we have done in Spain last year, that the immune system is significantly impaired, not to the extent we find in, say, protein energy malnutrition or severe nutrient, micronutrient deficiencies in developing countries or even in the elderly, but still there is a substantial reduction in responses, and many of them do get more infections. It's a common experience among marathon runners, for instance, that after they run the race, within about 24 to 48 hours, most men will come down with a cold. And I think this could reflect the adverse effect of very severe prolonged exercise on immunity. On the other hand, moderate sustained exercise actually boosts the immune system. And we have shown this quite clearly in the elderly who, if they exercise gently, say walking or swimming, even 25 minutes, 3-4 times a week, have a better immune system compared with those who are sedentary. So once again, we talk of a balance, neither too little nor too much.
I'd like to shift slightly to talking about some single nutrients and their personalities as it relates to the immune system. And I'm reminded back a number of years ago the work of Dr. Lucille Hurley at University of California, Davis, on zinc nutrition in primates. And as I recall, she did some interesting studies on deprivation of the mother of zinc and finding that the offspring had adversely impacted immune systems, and it took something like 2 to 3 generations of repletion to bring them back to the F0 generation. Could you tell us a little bit about zinc as an important nutrient for the developing immune system and how that relates to infant and child nutrition as you see it in the world of today?
Yes. I think zinc is among the foremost micronutrients that have a profound effect on the immune system, and certainly the late Lucille Hurley showed that if mothers were deprived of zinc, even pre-gestation and certainly during pregnancy and lactation, then their offspring had reduced antibody responses to antigens which depend upon T cells. And she did find, in fact, she confirmed what we had published in Science several years before that, that these offspring, when mated with healthy males, and even though they were not deprived of zinc anymore, the second generation, or grandchildren, if you will, continued to show some depression of the immune system. It wasn't as profound as in the animals who were actually starved or deprived of zinc. So it is true that nutrition during pregnancy or even pre-pregnancy has a very important and perhaps a very prolonged effect on the immune system of infants. It's been shown in rodents, it's been shown in primates, and it's been shown in humans.
Do you think, given your work and your observations, that there is any suggestion of the need for zinc augmentation in children's diets or throughout development, say even in adolescence?
Well, it's a moot question. I would have no hesitation in recommending it for low birth weight infants, those whose weight is less than 2.5 kilograms at the time of birth, because we know that for the first 6 to 12 months, their immunity is low, and giving them an extra zinc, approximately 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram body weight, will boost their immune response and bring it back to normal in a shorter time period than if they were not given zinc. There is also some evidence that infants and young children, particularly boys, not so much in girls, if they are given zinc, they have a greater growth velocity for height. Now, it has not been shown conclusively whether it will also help their immune system at that age group. So far as adolescents are concerned, I think it's not so much zinc, but iron, which seems to be the common problem. And if you give them iron, not only improves their immune responses, but also increases cognitive function and abstract thinking, and in particular their performance in mathematics.
Let me, if I can, move from trace elements over to the fat-soluble vitamin family and ask you your thoughts on the Medani and Bloomberg work at Tufts and the USDA Human Nutrition Center on Aging. I recall they authored a paper in the JAMA, I think, back in 1997 on vitamin E supplementation and in vivo immune responses in healthy elderly subjects. Do you feel that this vitamin E connection is proving out in the last 3 or 4 years as being an important part of the story?
Certainly, vitamin E is among the group of vitamins which is important for immune system. And gradually we are increasing the recommendation for the amount of vitamin E that should be consumed, from about 10 milligrams some years ago to now perhaps 30 to 40 milligrams. I wrote a commentary in the same issue of JAMA on their paper and on vitamin E in general. And basically, I concluded after reviewing their paper and other literature that somewhere between 50 to 100 milligrams might be the amount of vitamin E needed for optimum immune response. I don't feel that giving amounts more than that will substantively benefit immunity or do anything to the incidence of infection. We certainly need more study to confirm what has been found in Boston, but certainly even with the present evidence, some extra amount of vitamin E would be justified in the elderly. Their study was done in old people, so in that age group, I would have no hesitation in recommending certainly anywhere from 50 to 100 milligrams.
I think it's very interesting in their paper, as I recall, they had a very significant increase in immune response or titers to hepatitis B. It was something like several fold higher in the vitamin E supplemented group, and they used graded doses. And I guess the question that you're raising is, where does the curvilinear dose response curve show maximum improvement for some of these functions?
It's interesting that, see, they used four different doses, including a placebo. And for three responses, including the response to hepatitis vaccine that you just mentioned, 200 milligram gave the best response. But for other responses, for example, lymphocyte transformation or other things, it was 60 milligram which was the best. And certainly, the group given the large amount of 800 milligram was probably the worst. In fact, sometime it performed worse than the placebo. As with other nutrients, we must recognize that there's always a bell-shaped curve for each nutrient and immunity. And now where the peak will be has to be determined for each nutrient by careful long-term studies, well-designed studies. And the other point I want to just make in relationship to this is that human nutrition means that we should look at all nutrients. And even though some nutrients may be more important than others, I think a balanced food and supplement that includes all essential nutrients would be my favorite choice rather than focusing only on one nutrient.
That's very, very wise, and I think your construct of the bell-shaped dose response curve is something for all clinicians to keep in mind. If a little is good, a whole lot more is not necessarily better, and
right.
I think that's a very wise bit of observation. One other area that you have recently published on, which I think is clinically very useful, it was a European Journal of Clinical Nutrition paper that you authored, relates to the effect that enteric flora has on immune function in the individual, and this was a paper I'm quoting from Enhancement of Natural Immune Function by Dietary Consumption of Bifidobacteria.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about this connection between the gut and the immune system? That, for some of our clinicians, may be an unusual connection.
Yeah. Although it has been suspected for a long time, and this originated from studies on young infants who were either breastfed or not breastfed, because in the breastfed infants, you have more of these lactic acid bacteria compared with the other microflora in formula-fed babies. And the breastfed babies have less infection and less allergies. So this has been now extrapolated to other age groups. And in the paper you just referred to, we studied elderly people and gave them a particular strain of bifidobacterium for 6 months. But even within 3 months, we found a very significant increase in cell-mediated immunity and natural killer cell activity, and also to some extent in phagocytic function. Now, there are two other areas in which this kind of approach is being used. One is in prevention and treatment of diarrhea, including traveler's diarrhea. Let's say we are traveling to a developing country in Asia or Africa or Central America, then taking a dose of lactobacilli, and it could be any one of the strains, is helpful in preventing diarrhea. And similarly, if an infant already has diarrhea, giving them these bacilli will help reduce the duration of it. We have a couple of papers that are in press confirming this, and also another paper showing it may even prevent eczema and respiratory problems in infants who may be prone because of genetic factors to develop allergies.
Dr. Chandra, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Obviously, we could go on and on. Your work has spanned so much in the field, it's really carved out the field. I can certainly understand why you have been awarded an Officer of the Order of Canada with the highest award given to Canadian citizens for your contributions. I think you've spurred on countless numbers of students, of which I'm very proud to call myself one, as we look at this field very intensely. And I think people who have followed your work have been able to manage their patients with a better sense of nutrition and immunity that hopefully have resulted in better outcome for their patients. So I personally want to thank you on behalf of the tens of thousands of clinicians who have benefited from your work.
Thank you so much. You've been very generous in your comments, and it's been a privilege talking to you.
It's been my privilege, and we wish you the best in your continued work, and we'll follow you very closely in your publications.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
One of the features that many clinicians are using to improve immune-related function in aging individuals is EDTA chelation therapy, and I was very interested recently to see a paper that appeared in Clinical and Experimental Pharmacology and Physiology, volume 26, page 853, talking about the effects of chelation with EDTA and vitamin B therapy on nitric oxide-related endothelial vasomotor function. And as you know, nitric oxide is very important as a vasodilator and improves endothelial function. It used to be called endothelial relaxing factor, or EDRF, and then it was later found to be nitric oxide, which was derived by the enzyme nitric oxide synthase through the agency of the amino acid arginine going to citrulline and producing nitric oxide. In this paper, what they wanted to evaluate as to whether a combination of B vitamin therapy along with EDTA chelation therapy had an effect upon the production of nitric oxide, which is an immune modulator as well as a vasodilator. So when they studied this in a variety of subjects who got a series of EDTA infusions, 1.5 grams 10 times over 6 weeks in 8 subjects with coronary heart disease, it was found that there was a selective increase in the vasodilator responses to acetylcholine after therapy with EDTA, and it only was seen when the patients were given simultaneously B-group vitamins, indicating a synergy between EDTA and B vitamins. Now, the mechanism by which this works was not defined, and what they called for were more definitive studies on these aspects, but it seems that there is an interesting interrelationship in these patients with existing arterial disease between EDTA chelation therapy and B vitamin nutriture on the production of this immune active messenger nitric oxide and its relationship also on vasodilation. Interesting report. In our discussion concerning nutrition and immunity, Dr. Chandra raised several interesting points about various aspects of our nutrient intake that could have positive roles on immunological status. One of these was our discussion concerning antioxidants and the work of Dr. Simon Maidani and Dr. Jeffrey Bloomberg at the Tufts USDA Human Nutrition Center on Aging in Boston. In a report by these investigators entitled Vitamin E Supplementation and In Vivo Immune Response in Healthy Elderly Subjects, this was the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 277, page 1380, the study was to determine whether long-term supplementation with vitamin E enhances in vivo clinically relevant measures of cell-mediated immunity in healthy elderly subjects. It was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled intervention study with a total of 88 free-living healthy subjects, at least 65 years of age. Subjects were randomly assigned to a placebo group or to groups who were consuming 60, 200, or 800 milligrams per day of vitamin E for about two-thirds of a year. The main outcome measures that they used to evaluate nutritional impact on immunity include delayed type hypersensitivity skin response, antibody response to hepatitis B, tetanus and diphtheria, and pneumococcal vaccines, and autoantibodies to DNA and thyroglobulin that were assessed before and after supplementation as part of looking at autoimmunity in comparison to immune cell recognition. Again, as Dr. Chandra pointed out in his review of the paper, there were different effects at different dose levels to the different parameters, and probably somewhere between the 100 and 200 milligram per day level was where you got kind of the optimization of all the parameters studied. It was interesting to note that at the very high dose intake, which was the highest dose chosen, the 800 milligrams a day, which was arbitrarily chosen by the investigators to be a very high dose, it was found that they had the most suppression of autoantibodies, suggesting that high doses of vitamin E may have a suppressive effect upon autoantibody production, whereas lower levels of vitamin E intake may more favorably increase cell-mediated immunological function and B-cell function. So, again, where do the curves cross to maximize the benefit? And somewhere between the 100 and 200 milligram per day level appeared to be that point where you got optimization of those values. The interesting point was at that dose you got improvement of response to various vaccinations, while you also got reduced levels of autoantibody to thyrotropin. So if there is a principal factor of accelerated biological aging that's associated with autoantibodies to the endocrine glands, meaning a person becomes allergic to their own endocrine glands, then it would imply by this study that proper antioxidant vitamin E intake is helpful in stabilizing the immune system against crosstalk with the immune system and the endocrine system. Crosstalk meaning losing that recognition of friend and foe and starting to respond to the body as if it were a foe. What about the role of the antioxidants when taken at higher doses for cardiovascular protection and other positive health benefit outcomes? As you know, there's a very wide range of controversy about vitamin E and heart disease, which just goes from soup to nuts, it seems, in the literature recently. A paper in The Lancet entitled Secondary Prevention with Antioxidants of Cardiovascular Disease and End-Stage Renal Disease. This was a randomized placebo-controlled trial using 800 international units per day of vitamin E or placebo. This was published in The Lancet, volume 356, page 1213. In the year 2000. What they talked about is the fact that there's excess cardiovascular mortality in those individuals who are on hemodialysis. They suggest that this is interrelated to oxidative stress, which is seen to be much greater in hemodialysis patients with increased blood malonaldehyde levels, meaning higher levels of lipid peroxidation as measured in their blood from the TBA test. So they investigated the effect of high-dose vitamin E on cardiovascular disease outcomes in these hemodialysis patients who had pre-existing cardiovascular disease, and they saw quite a significant improvement in those patients who got the 800 IUs per day in their outcome. They said it reduced composite cardiovascular disease endpoints and myocardial infarction at a statistically significant level, less than half the prevalence actually in the vitamin E supplemented group versus the placebo group. Now, that paper created quite an interesting series of responses in The Lancet and later issues. I think the most interesting of those was the response by Sarah Nuttall and her colleagues from the Division of Medical Sciences at Queen Elizabeth Hospital, in which they said that this paper by Boas and colleagues showed that regular supplementation of vitamin E reduced the risk of composite cardiovascular endpoints, myocardial infarction, ischemic stroke, and peripheral vascular disease in patients on hemodialysis. But this finding seems to be in contrast with the recent heart outcomes prevention evaluation study in which vitamin E seemed to have no significant effect in patients at high risk of cardiovascular disease, whereas in the Cambridge Heart Antioxidant Study, the so-called CHAOS study, C-H-A-O-S study, there was an effect on non-fatal myocardial infarction but not mortality, whereas in the GISSI prevention trial, the opposite seems to have been shown. The lack of a clear message might promote confusion and skepticism, which is unfortunate but predictable if varying doses of antioxidants are given to different populations and several endpoints are reported. She goes on to say with her group, surely the time has come when oxidant stress, i.e. the imbalance between free radical production and antioxidant defenses, should be studied in high-risk patients who are given an antioxidant regimen that restores plasma or tissue antioxidant activity to normal. Appropriate endpoints should be identified and the effect of antioxidant treatments documented. The establishing of an association between correction of oxidant stress and clinical endpoints would have improved the BOAS study. It's interesting to note that they went on to say that they suspect that the effects on oxidant stress had been assessed, the results would have been confounded by the prescribed cocktail that was not only vitamin E, but an additional level of substances, including folate, between 5 and 10 milligrams per day. That's 5,000 to 10,000 micrograms per day, vitamin B6, 10 to 250 milligrams per day, and vitamin B12, 250 micrograms per day, which would lower homocysteine concentrations, which are associated at high homocysteine with increased free radical production. And therefore, are we looking at single variables or multiple variables? Vitamin C supplements, 100 to 500 milligrams per day, have also been shown to have a synergistic action with vitamin E. Boas and colleagues did not discuss the relevance of these other antioxidants and primary or secondary endpoints, nor reveal whether more endpoints were reached in patients who received only vitamin E or placebo. The distribution of these other antioxidants was near equal, although the doses are not given. So it's clear that when you start using complex mixtures of antioxidants, you get the antioxidant buddy system, the electron transfer system, starting to have potentially synergistic effects that you would not see with single antioxidants taken by themselves. This redox buffering, so to speak, the reduction oxidation buffering provided by complex antioxidant mixtures, is a much different influence potentially on oxidative stress than just giving single antioxidants. So the BOAS study, the results are certainly of interest. Trials, however, may show that antioxidants can help patients with renal disease as a consequence of increased oxidative stress, and that this may be most beneficial when you give a complex array of antioxidants. And this goes back to what Dr. Chandra was telling us in his very eloquent interview, in which he talked about complex mixtures of nutrients found in whole foods, that certainly nutritional supplements can be of value, but that food is very important because it provides an array of redox active substances, particularly the phenols and the flavonoid compounds, which work together with the water and fat-soluble antioxidants to deliver redox protection. And so, therefore, when we start looking at the role of antioxidants in the protection against age-related diseases, I think, once again, the story is complex mixtures rather than single agents. This is also seen in another recent paper published in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Effects of Vitamin E on Lipid Peroxidation in Healthy Subjects. This is volume 285, page 1178 in the year 2001. In this study, oxidative stress was to be evaluated before and after a vitamin E supplementation. To assess the effects of vitamin E, they used a randomized controlled trial, 30 healthy men aged 18 to 60 years of age, and participants were randomly assigned to either receive placebo or a vitamin E alpha tocopherol supplement at doses of 200, 400, 800, 1200, or 2000 international units a day for 8 weeks, followed by an 8-week washout period. They looked at indices of lipid peroxidation by urinary 4-hydroxynonenal, 2-isoprostanes, as well as looking at the TBA active material, thiobarbituric acid active material. Circulating vitamin E levels, as you could imagine, increased in the dose-response-dependent manner during the study, and they found no significant effect of vitamin E at any levels on urinary 4-hydroxynonenal or isoprostane. They came to conclude that the vitamin E supplementation did not appear to reduce the indices of oxidative stress that they measured, and therefore they're suggesting that possibly vitamin E is not in itself a preventive supplement for defense against oxidative stress. I think that that conclusion is a little premature and certainly not warranted in the whole because, as I mentioned, vitamin E works as a redox buddy within this buddy system of electron exchange. And if you don't have the ability for the electron that goes from the tocopherol oxy radical to be transferred over to something else, be it glutathione or the regeneration from glutathione disulfide of glutathione or lipoic acid, then you stop the chain breaking mechanism that is found with vitamin E as part of its radical protection against free radicals. You then are less effective in realizing its oxidant stress protection than if it was to be given along with the other agents at work as part of this buddy team, this teamwork system for diffusing oxidative stress. I think we're going to see much more research moving away from the pharmacological model of nutrition, which is one agent at a time against one endpoint, and looking at what really happens in human physiology, which is complex arrays of similar molecules that have similar function and how they function against a variety of physiological outcome parameters. So what would have happened if this study would have been done with vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, N-acetylcysteine, lipoic acid, polyphenols? I mean, where would we have seen the same results, or would we have seen something different on the production of 4-hydroxynonenal or the isoprostanes? I think, again, the question is, what level of stress were these individuals under? Was there already a significant amount of oxidative stress? Could we have looked at things like the degree of 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, or 8-OHDG, which is a measure of oxidative damage to DNA, and correlated that with oxidative stress markers before and after supplementation with a complex array of antioxidants? I think you'll get the drift of what I'm talking about here, that one needs to be very cautious about how you set the study up before you set up your hypotheses, because there may be a rationale incorporated within your study design that have already predetermined what type of results that you're getting. As Dr. Chandra pointed out, that when looking at complex outcome variables like immunological function against complex inputs from multinutrient diets, we need to have a kind of a pattern that recognizes, a pattern recognition protocol to evaluate the impact of a complex diet on complex immunological parameters and even something as complex as oxidative stress. Well, let me move to the other area that Dr. Chandra talked about, which is allergic disorders. I think this is a very interesting part of the emerging story because it seems that more and more people are becoming allergic to their world, to their diet, to their environment, resulting in the allergy medications becoming in the top leaders of prescribed medications today as our population becomes more asthmatic, as we become more atopic, as we become more allergic, then the antihistamines and the allergy relief medications become much more prevalent in our prescribing patterns and our use patterns. Let's talk about allergy and allergic diseases according to a recent review in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 344, page 109, in the year 2001. Allergic rhinitis, as you know, is characterized by episodes of sneezing, itching, rhinorrhea, and nasal obstruction. And currently, the drugs used to treat allergic rhinitis are antihistamines and anticholinergic agents, which are principally for the relief of symptoms, and topical corticosteroids to suppress allergic inflammation. Histamine H2 receptor antagonists are less sedating and more pharmacologically selective than other earlier antihistamines and are now getting kind of the inside track for use. Some H2 receptors and H1 receptor antagonists reportedly inhibit allergen-induced infiltration of tissues by eosinophils, and we are now starting to look at biological basis of allergy and modulating some of these processes. Specific immunotherapy, which has been used for the treatment of allergic diseases for nearly 100 years, consists of desensitizing a person to their allergen by administering increasing concentrations of extract of the allergen over a long period of time. In some patients with seasonal allergic rhinitis, this has been a successful way of approaching, but there are many patients who do not respond favorably with good outcome to the desensitization approach using concentrations of extracts of allergen. The mode of action of specific immunotherapy is complex and still certainly under discovery and more explication. You'd think by this time with the ever-increasing knowledge we have of the immune system, we'd understand how one gets this desensitization to occur at the immunological level, but really the story is still being unraveled. We know that IgG, immunoglobulin G, blocking antibodies compete with IgE for allergen, and they may have also the ability to prevent the aggregation of complexes of IgE and other alpha chain of the high affinity IgE receptors on mast cells by altering the steric conformation. In addition, they may interfere with antigen trapping by IgE bound to antigen-presenting cells. In fact, I think several studies have shown that specific immunotherapy is known to inhibit the release of pharmacological mediators from mast cells like interleukins and leukotrienes, pro-inflammatory prostanoids, and inhibit the release of these from mast cells and basophils, which then prevents infiltration of allergic lesions by inflammatory cells and decreases the number of mast cells in tissues. In this mast cell degranulation process, once you get an IgE bound to the cell surface of a mast cell, which then causes a conformational transformation of an inactive phospholipase to an active phospholipase, that then causes the breakdown of phosphatidyl-containing molecules. These would be your phospholipid molecules, releasing from the 2-position them by a phospholipase of arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is the rate-limiting release in this process of the steps of inflammation from the mast cell, which then delivers the arachidonate available to lipoxygenase that can convert it into leukotrienes like leukotriene B4, which are highly pro-inflammatory and actually about 1,000 times more pro-inflammatory than histamine, for an example. These then are released by the mast cell and cause chemotaxis of white cells, swelling, water retention, pain, and the responses that we normally associate with allergy. So the mast cell degranulation process and the activation of the arachidonic acid cascade plays a very important role in the pathogenesis of allergy, and it's interrelated with the IgG blocking antibodies that compete with IgE for allergen. Dr. Vincent Marinkovich, an allergist and immunologist at Stanford University Medical School and one of our core faculty for Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice training programs, has spoken to some great length about the important role that IgG plays in these IgE reactions and the immune complex association between too little immune complex formation and too much immune complex formation, and kind of this dose response continuum where in the middle the body has normal surveillance of IgG putting the brake on IgE. The relationship that we're talking about here has something to do with the balance of the thymus-dependent lymphocyte activity, the so-called thymus-dependent 1 or Th1 and the thymus-dependent 2 or Th2 systems. The thymus-dependent 1, Th1 cytokines, interferon gamma, interleukin 12, IgG, versus the thymus-dependent 2 or Th2 interleukins, which include interleukin 4, interleukin 5, and IgE. So the balance between the Th1 side and the Th2 side plays a very important role in kind of having the brake on, but also having your foot on the accelerator kind of simultaneously, so the body can respond to a potential noxious agent with appropriate immune response, but not be in a freewheeling situation with no brakes. This Th1-Th2 balance and how it interrelates with nutrition is starting to play a role in our understanding, and how nutrition interrelates with the environment, environmental exposures, and how that relates then to genetic predisposition through histocompatibility, locus antigen determinants, HLAs. And so we're starting to actually get a molecular picture that may help to predict from first principles what patient would respond to what type of an allergen and what type of nutritional support may they require for optimization of that balance between Th1 and Th2. This theme is further mirrored in the article entitled Tolerance and Autoimmunity that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 344, page 655 in 2001. The immunological specificity of the antigen receptors of T cells and B cells, as you know, is a result of this random shuffling of the many genes that form the DNA code of the antigen binding site. It's amazing to think about how a single genome could code for so many different variations by this shuffling process, so that it would be able to respond to molecules that would be put into the environment that it never knew that it would be exposed to, that the organism had never seen before. How did it have that pluripotentiality? Well, it's been found that this process can generate 10 to the 9th different T-cell receptors. It's not infinite, but that's a heck of a lot of variation that the body can mobilize and respond to based upon the mixing and matching of these many genes that form the DNA code of the antigen binding site. Tolerance, then, is the process that eliminates or neutralizes such autoreactive cells, and a breakdown in the working of the system obviously can result in what we call autoimmunity. So this balance that one might recognize in self from non-self, that has everything to do with immune suppression on one part of the immune system to autoimmunity on another part of the immune system, is all related to communication that's broken down in the system. And as Dr. Chandra pointed out very beautifully, it's very possible that a person has simultaneously alterations in their cell-mediated immunity and also an increased relationship to autoimmunity, where their self versus non-self loses discrimination. Autoantibodies are characteristic of many autoimmune diseases and can be the direct cause of the lesions in some of these disorders. For instance, in Graves' disease of the thyroid, autoantibodies bind to and stimulate the receptor for thyrotropin, which then creates increased oxidative reactions and inflammatory mediation. Autoantibodies against intracellular antigens are not usually pathogenic, but instead have been viewed largely as secondary consequences of the autoimmune process, and therefore triggered from outside messages of the cell to inside reactions that kind of slows down or alters cellular function. So these autoimmune processes may be everything from kind of mild in symptomatology at the cell-specific level, way up to obviously pathophysiological features of the classic autoimmune diseases, systemic lupus erythematosus, myasthenia gravis, rheumatoid arthritis, and the like. When we start looking at this range of functions, I think we can see that depending on where the imbalance is between Th1 and Th2 and how severe these imbalances are found, one might get increasing pathogenicity that ultimately ends up in end organ failure or pathology that we identify as an autoimmune disease. But patients may present with much more mild symptoms of more subtle imbalances. And this is where some of the nutrition, both allergenic potentiation and imbalanced nutrition as it relates to these nutrient impacts on immunological function, play an important role. The essential fatty acids, the antioxidants, the zinc, the other trace minerals, including iron, how do they play a role in the balancing of these immunological factors? A very, very interesting part of the story. As I mentioned, T cells can be categorized, or thymus-dependent lymphocytes can be categorized according to the cytokines they produce. The type 1 helper T cells produce mainly interferon gamma, tumor necrosis factor, and interleukin-2. So we would normally call these like the inflammatory producing T cells because of these cytokines that they elaborate, which are pro-inflammatory. Whereas the type 2 T cells, the Th2s, produce mainly interleukin-4, interleukin-5, interleukin-13, which are often considered more anti-inflammatory cytokines, and therefore the balance between the Th1 and the Th2 plays very important roles. However, imbalances of either side of the equation, either Th1 or Th2, can be associated with specific pathogenicities. For instance, multiple sclerosis and type 1 diabetes are mainly mediated by Th1 cells, whereas allergic diseases are mediated by Th2 cells. Alteration of the cytokine balance, therefore, is an appealing therapeutic possibility to reset the fulcrum on this balance beam between the Th1 and Th2-derived cytokines. And I want to emphasize that nutrients have been found to play a role in establishing that fulcrum. It's not the only factor, obviously. Genes play an important role and other environmental factors play an important role. But it is one of the determining variables for where that fulcrum is placed between the elaboration and activation of Th2 versus Th1-mediated effects. I think as one starts to apply the story that Dr. Chandra has been emerging through his extensive research over the last 40 years, one starts to look at variables such as antigenic principles in the environment, removing them as to the extent possible. This is the elimination diet or the cleaning up the localized environment, but also trying to improve immunological recognition through proper nutritional support, proper protein levels, balance of carbohydrate to protein to fats, the right kind of fats, less saturated fat, more omega-3 oils that are in essential fatty acids, trying to get adequate trace minerals, particularly zinc and magnesium, which play important roles in immunological defense mechanisms, the proper ratio of calcium to magnesium, proper antioxidants in the right ratio and balance, not just the antioxidant of the month club, but the proper balance of antioxidants, vitamin C, vitamin E, the carotenoids, the flavonoids, polyphenolic compounds, the selenium, cysteine, lipoic acid, coenzyme Q10, that whole family of redox active substances, and the important role that specific amino acids may play, like arginine, for instance, in immunological recognition, or L-glutamine. All of these are very important parts of the story. It's interesting when you look at certain very extraordinary inflammatory conditions associated with autoimmunity or immune hypersensitivity, you can start picking up a variety of disorders in the literature which may be in part exacerbated by these imbalances of genes in an environment. One of them, which is discussed recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, is entitled Sclerosing Pancreatitis. It's been referred to not only as sclerosing pancreatitis, but primary inflammatory pancreatitis, lymphoblastic sclerosing pancreatitis, autoimmune pancreatitis, chronic pancreatitis with diffuse irregular narrowing of the main pancreatic duct, and sclerosing pancreocholangitis. So a lot of different names for the same condition. It's a term, however, that's associated with lymphoblastic inflammation of the pancreas and hypergammaglobulinemia in response to glucocorticoid treatment. It's recently been found in this article in the New England Journal of Medicine to be associated with IgG4 elevations. As you probably know, IgG4 is the rarest of the IgG subclasses and accounts for only 3-6% of the total IgG in the serum of normal subjects. It is unique among the IgG subclasses in its ability to bind complement CIQ and therefore activate the classical pathway of complement, and in its low affinity for a target antigen. Because high serum IgG4 concentrations are found only in a limited number of conditions, including things like atopic dermatitis and other atopic disorders that are allergic-related, and things like parasitic diseases, it's been found maybe that IgG4 could be a useful kind of marker for some of these underlying inflammatory conditions that are associated with allergy that may then be amenable to elimination or environmental hygiene or nutritional modification in the case where there's a nutritional allergic response. So again, I think that IgG4, a subclass of IgG, may be useful, the balance of IgE and IgG, and then the interrelationships between the Th1 and the Th2 cytokines, looking at this important balance and how diet and environment and lifestyle play a role in that. An emerging, very interesting topic, obviously, in clinical nutrition and clinical allergy and immunology, where there seems to be a very interesting interface that is occurring between the two as they converge in their disciplines. Let me move to the other area that Dr. Chandra talked about, which I think is very important for this discussion this month, and that is the relationship between gut flora and immunological function. Recall, if you would, that nearly two-thirds of the immune system is clustered around the gastrointestinal tract, the so-called gut-associated lymphoid tissue, or GALT. This particular interrelationship between a complex food matrix and bacterial flora, a kilogram to a kilogram and a half of living flora of different species in the gut that are producing their own chemical personalities, in close proximity to the GALT can result in immunological either activation or potentiation based upon what chemical exposures the GALT is receiving. Interestingly enough, we now recognize that differing bacteria that are involved in cultured food products may have differing effects upon the immunological function of the gut, the so-called gut-associated lymphoid tissue, or the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, the MALT, M-A-L-T. In a recent paper in the Journal of Dairy Science, which I think is a very nice paper, volume 84, page 319 in the year 2001, the scientific basis of one species of oral supplemented probiotic was evaluated as a functional agent to improve gastrointestinal and immune function. This is a Lactobacillus acidophilus NCFM strain. The Lactobacillus acidophilus NCFM strain has a number of very favorable personality characteristics when given as a supplement. It's known to adhere to the mucus secreting cells, which is very important if it's going to stick around after oral supplementation. It's known to produce antimicrobial compounds that help to defend against parasitic bacterial levels within the gut. It's amenable to gastrointestinal survival, so it doesn't just pass right on through it. It actually adheres to the mucosal cells and can proliferate. It inhibits aberrant crypt formation in animals that have been exposed to mutagens, suggesting that its activity could decrease the risk of colon cancer through favorable markers that it produces in the colon as a consequence of its metabolism, things like butyrate, for instance, because it's known to be a very good butyrate producer by fermenting non-digestible carbohydrates such as fructose oligosaccharides. So if you administer the appropriate dietary fermentable carbohydrate, non-digestible in the normal human but fermentable by these NCFM strains, then it can produce these anti-mutagens like butyrate. The blend of NCFM strains decreased the incidence of pediatric diarrhea in clinical trials and led to significant decreases in the levels of toxic amines like cadaverine and putrescine, the names alone probably give you some of the origin of them, in the blood of dialysis patients with small bowel bacterial overgrowth. So it can be suggested that at adequate daily feeding levels, NCFM may facilitate whole range of favorable influences on gastrointestinal function, including some of the immune benefits. It's also been shown to facilitate lactose digestion in lactose intolerant subjects, suggesting it has lactose enzyme fermenting capability. The story I'm trying to leave you with is that we're moving away from thinking of nutrition solely as the vitamins, minerals, protein, carbohydrate, fat, and water, to now looking at a variety of other associated agents which work together synergistically to give rise to the liberation of nutrients or the production of other trophic factors that includes even living flora that are now called probiotic. In fact, there was a paper, as you know, in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1996 that reviewed a neglected modality, biotherapeutic methods for recurrent vaginitis and functional gastrointestinal disorders. And those biotherapeutic sources they were talking about was the use of probiotics and prebiotics for the management of recurrent vaginal infections and for functional gastroenterological problems, including chronic irritable bowel syndrome. So I think we're starting to witness the emergence of a new important adjunctive tool in clinical nutrition and maybe clinical immunology called probiotics, the Lactobacillus acidophilus NCFM strain and its interrelationship then with other substrates like non-digestible carbohydrates such as inulin, which is oligosaccharide containing substrate upon which the NCFM strain can produce favorable secondary byproducts like butyrate. By the way, there may be a variety of other species of probiotics that have differing effects upon immunological function of the gut, and therefore one could consider kind of a broad spectrum of different replacement bacteria that may have different effects at different regions within the immunological cascade and therefore produce a very favorable outcome in patients. As you probably recognize from discussions we had years ago, in aging individuals, one of the characteristics that has been seen when doing stool cultures is after the age of 50, the loss of bifidobacteria and the rapid gain in prevalence of the parasitic anaerobic bacteria, which then start to grow in great numbers after the age of 50 as the bifidobacteria start to decline. Up until that time, the bifidobacteria were, in most healthy individuals, seen as the predominant bacterial species, but they start to decline rapidly as the toxic bacteria start to increase in their prevalence. Does this directly relate to age-related disorders? That's a good question. According to Ely Metchnikoff, back at the turn of the 19th going into the 20th century, he felt that this was a major cause of premature aging, this alteration of gut bacterial flora. You might recall his book, The Prolongation of Life. Remember, he was the director of the Pasteur Institute and had won a Nobel Prize in medicine in the late 19th century for the discovery that he made of the macrophage, and was one of the real primary discoverers of the immune system as looking at the blood microscopically. And he felt toxic bacteria in the colon had a very significant role to play in modifying immunological function, and that by reinstilling friendly bacteria by enemas into hospitalized patients, that he could improve their liver function, their kidney function, and their overall vitality. So this concept of a toxic bacterial overgrowth having an impact upon immune and general function in aged individuals has a long-standing history in medicine. And probably now we're for the first time starting to gain a better understanding of how this works through receptor sites and modification of gene expression and influences upon colonocyte replication and DNA masking effects that the acetylation has in the butyrate levels that then influences how genes in the colon are expressed into functional phenotypes. This is taking old observational work and creating new molecular biology explanations for their function, but the outcome to the patient may remain the same regardless of the explanation, and that is improved gastrointestinal immune function, lowered systemic inflammatory markers, and a decreased risk to some immunological dysregulation, the Th1 and Th2 cytokine imbalance. I might emphasize that this Th1-Th2 connection also interrelates to the kind of non-digestible carbohydrate one consumes. There's a report implied in Environmental Microbiology that describes fermentation of fructose oligosaccharides by lactic acid bacteria and bifidobacteria, showing that inulin is metabolized or fermented by only specific species of bacteria, and some other bacteria like Streptococcus thermophilus do not ferment these substrates, and therefore the different types of oligosaccharides have differing fermentabilities depending upon the type of bacteria that are present in the gut that produce then the outcome and byproducts such as butyrate. So it's the right bacteria, the right substrate, the right GI environment, and the right overall nutrition that then has an effect systemically on the immune system. Very interesting connection that I think Dr. Chandra certainly caused us to look at most significantly. Let me shift, if I can, from this topic for just a couple of other clinical comments. First of all, there are many individuals who have been following the story related to folic acid needs, the homocysteine connection, and its relationship to a variety of different age-related disorders, cutting across such things as cognitive decline and dementia, cardiovascular risk, cerebrovascular risk, and even hormone-related cancers and other cancers that are interrelated to folic acid and B12 metabolic defects. This is seen to be related to an enzyme polymorphism called the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. That is the enzyme that's very important for making 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, the active methylating derivative of folic acid that forms S-adenosylmethionine, which then is the deliverer of methyl groups through an enzyme called catechol-O-methyltransferase. So polymorphisms of methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase can then result in defects in how a person utilizes folic acid, may require then much higher levels of folic acid to get the same outcome. So if that's the case, and if the methylation of genes is very important for the cell signaling process and prevention against carcinogenic injury, then you might say, could MTHFR polymorphisms have anything to do with the risk of childhood leukemia? Is this indicating that there might be an interrelationship between this pathway? And that was described in a recent issue of the PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in their volume 98, page 4009, 2001 issue, in which methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase polymorphisms and the risk of molecularly defined subtypes of childhood leukemia was evaluated, and it was found, lo and behold, that yes, there were very strong associations between this polymorphism of the ability to use folate effectively and the development of some types of pediatric acute leukemia. Now, this clearly doesn't give this as the only route towards developing leukemia, but it tends to tie the story together that if an infant is born with this genetic polymorphism and they have not been getting adequate folate, therefore their methylation pathways have been reduced or impaired, that it may then alter gene expression, may put at risk specific types of mutational injuries which can be carcinogenic, and induce then increasing frequency and prevalence of leukemia. So the story of folate B12, B6, methyl donors like betaine goes even in utero beyond that of Down syndrome, beyond that of neural tube defects, to even possibly relate to things like leukemia and the important role then that folate sufficiency for the woman's own genotype plays in this process. Let's look also at the relationship we've been talking about pertaining to blood sugar and insulin resistance and dietary variables. I'm now in the zone, so to speak, with this discussion because, as you know, there's this big construct that has emerged that dietary carbohydrate is bad and dietary protein is much better for individuals who have insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. Dr. Gerald Reaven talked about this last month in our June 2001 issue of Functional Medicine Update as our Clinician of the Month, and brought us to the realization that it probably was not the carbohydrate and protein levels or ratios that were the most important, but rather the type of fat and the relative amount of fat, with saturated fat once again being the real problem child. This reminisces very nicely to the discussion I've already had this month around APOE4 alleles and how they're fully expressed as an oxidant stress factor when the individual consumes a high saturated fat diet. So one might ask the question, is there any data that says that protein intake given isocalorically to carbohydrate can have impact on insulin increases? And that's a very interesting question which has recently been evaluated, and a published paper from the work of Nuttall et al. Some of you know of his works, a section of endocrinology, metabolism, and nutrition at the Metabolic Research Laboratory at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine. And this was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, Volume 86, page 1040, in the year 2001. Now, the title of it is Effect of Protein Ingestion on the Glucose Appearance Rate in People with Type 2 Diabetes. And in this particular cohort of individuals that had insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and type 2 diabetes, these were 10 male subjects who were then given 50 grams of protein in the form of very lean beef or water, and studied over the subsequent 8 hours. So this was like a protein tolerance test versus a glucose tolerance test. And protein ingestion was found to result in an increase in circulating insulin, C-peptide, glucagon, alpha amino acids, and urea nitrogen and triglycerides. suggesting that protein, given as a complex dietary mixture of amino acids, has a similar insulogenic effect to that of carbohydrate. In fact, when I look at the data from the trial, it's quite interesting. Figure 3 in the trial is the relationship of postprandial insulin response after a 50-gram protein load as lean beef, and the levels of fasting insulin go up from something in the range of 20 IUs per milliliter. Recall, if you would, these are insulinemic patients that are type 2 diabetic, so they already have a high fasting plasma insulin level. We normally wouldn't like to see this not any greater than 10, but these people had a baseline of around, between 20 and 30. And within a period of 2 hours, their postprandial insulin levels went up from 30 to, on the mean, a little bit above 80, which is about the kind of postprandial response you'd see with isocaloric level of carbohydrate given to these individuals as glucola, as sugar. So I guess we need to take off the table the premise that dietary protein does not increase postprandial insulin. It does in a measured way. In fact, the total amount of protein deaminated and converted then into ultimately urea was 20 to 30 grams, with about 12 grams being converted into sugar. So that means about half of the carbon skeletons in the protein administered was converted into glucose by the deamination and gluconeogenesis process in the liver in individuals that had type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia. So I think we need to get away from this view that we do not have a risk with protein. Also, what about peroxisome proliferated activated receptors, PPARs? Well, there's a very interesting paper that just appeared in Nature Medicine, Volume 7, page 41 in 2001, I want to bring to your attention. We know that omega-3 fatty acids, the EPA, is a very effective PPAR gamma agonist, and now it's been found that PPAR gammas, and that's peroxisome proliferated activated receptor gammas, are very important as anti-atherogenic agents. They play an important role in the protection against heart disease. Previous work using a macrophage cell line demonstrated that the activation of the PPAR gamma signaling process enhanced macrophage differentiation and prevented its atherogenicity. And it's recently been found in this paper and reported that PPAR agonists like the thiazolidinediol drugs or omega-3 fatty acids or conjugated linoleic acid are all known to increase then macrophage management and reduce atherogenicity. So the connection between insulin, the type of dietary fat, and heart disease may also be mitigated through the PPAR gamma pathway. Well, thanks very much for sharing with us this month the extraordinary concepts of Dr. Chandra and nutrition and immunity and how it relates to age-related diseases. Look forward to being with you in August. Thanks.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.